First, let me say I did make this trip in order to honor my good and old friend Boris Kaiser, since unfortunately I won't be able to be here on Boris Kaiser Day itself. So you might say that this is pre-Boris Kaiser Day, and I hope it's a warm-up for a very good celebration that comes along on Thursday. Let me also say, as Pasha indicated, I've been studying double beta decay since, I guess, almost before it was seen. And I'll talk about some of the experiments that have come along over the years. I should say that it's been a very profitable thing for me in relation to this particular campus, the University of California at Santa Barbara. I think this is the third time in my career that I've been invited simply because of double beta decay. I think the first time, and Boris, I may rely on your memory, there was a meeting here in the 80s.
meeting where?
Here at Santa Barbara, or maybe Dave remembers, because I remember that was the first time I met Till Kirsten, who did one of the most important early experiments in double beta decay, when you could really say after that experiment that the process had been seen. So that was the first time. The second time, and Dave should remember this, I was actually invited by, I think it was Bob Eisberg and Dave Caldwell and Mike Witherell to take a cruise one weekend. And I think we went out on Bob Eisberg's boat, if you remember. I can't remember that year either. But it was a very nice occasion. And so this is the third time then that double beta decay has brought me here to Santa Barbara, and I venture to hope that it won't be the last. Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay.
It was a few years ago. There was a conference on neutrino physics here in this room after the building had been built.
I don't know. Did I come?
Yes, you were there, because I remember John McCall making a remark about your work after you had left.
Okay. Okay. Well, back to double beta decay. If it is a fourth time, good, then let's hope there's a fifth. If you happen to notice, my title applies to both high energy and nuclear physics, and double beta decay really is a subject that crosses the boundary between these two fields. There's a lot of nuclear physics in it, and of course there's a lot of particle physics in it because of one's interest in the properties of the neutrino that emerge from this. I want to take a look backwards rather than a look forwards. This is a subject that moves at such a slow pace that it really it's relatively easy to do that. But I think it's interesting to look at the history and how the ideas that we think about now really have emerged over time. And I'd like to point out, Ina was talking about black holes with a lifetime of 10 to the minus 27 seconds. I'm talking about processes that have lifetimes of plus 10 to the 27 seconds. So it's the mirror image, if you like. Pardon?
It's only 54
orders of magnitude. Only 54 orders of magnitude difference. Okay. So what happens in double beta decay, of course, is you have a nucleus, a collection of neutrons and protons sitting around. And in this particular example, they're put in a magnetic field. So you'll have the two electrons coming out. And in this case, it shows two neutrinos because, of course, on the basis of the standard model, we do expect that process to occur. And the interest, of course, is the other process where the neutrinos don't emerge. Now, from an historical point of view, the very first mention of double beta decay was by Maria Gerpert Mayer in 1935, and she was asked by Eugene Wigner to look into calculating the double beta decay as a second order effect of the interaction that Fermi had introduced for ordinary beta decay. And the motivation behind that was a motivation of metastability of certain long-lived isotopes that one thought should decay. And is there a pointer somewhere? This is not a... Okay. The point that Mayer was involved with calculating was is illustrated here in the case of A equals 76, where you have germanium 76 over here. It can't decay to this nucleus over here because its mass is lower, but it can decay two places over to the selenium 82. And the question that she was addressing is, why was this such a long-lived isotope? Why, and similar isotopes that we'll deal with. Another example is one which is one of great experimental interest is selenium 82 over here, which again can't decay to the bromine, but it does decay to the krypton. And what the question is, why are these so long-lived? Maria Mayer calculated the lifetime in 1935 and found a lifetime of the order of 10 to the 17 years or more. And compared with geological time, that's a very long time even so. And so that was the answer to the question. Then going on in the history, where did I put? you had a paper by Majorana in 1937, which actually was a symmetric theory of the electron and positron. And what he did essentially was develop a representation of the gamma matrices in which the charge conjugation process was represented by the unit matrix, the charge conjugation matrix. And he noticed that you could also apply this to the neutrino as well as the electron, but he really didn't pursue that. The person who did pursue that was Racah in the same year, who asked the question, if you can have a neutrino that's identical with its antiparticle, what kind of experimental test could you make for that? And what he proposed was to do an experiment in which you produce a neutrino in, say, the decay of a neutron or the equivalent decay of a neutron, then make that second neutrino interact with a second neutrino and see if it will stimulate beta decay. He had in mind real neutrinos, so that you would actually have a two-stage process. Here would be your source of neutrinos, and here would be the detector. In fact, Ray Davis, in his very first experiment, tried to do exactly that. He took what we now call antineutrinos from a reactor and tried to do the chlorine 37 experiment using those. And as a kind of an historical byline, there were at some point rumors which reached Pontecorvo in Moscow that he was seeing a positive signal. And that was then gave Pontecorvo the idea of talking about oscillations from nu to nu bar, analogous to the oscillations that Gell-Mann and Pice had introduced for the K long and the K short. anyway, Racah had that idea. And then in 1939, Wendell Furry looked at the same thing and thought about the exchange of virtual neutrinos. And that's how the no-neutrino double beta decay idea came into being, that you could have a process going on inside the nucleus in which you would have just a virtual exchange. And one of the points about that virtual exchange is that it helps. Seem to have gotten my things. So it helps in the kinematics of the process. In the case of the two neutrino decay, you have four leptons in the final state, and if you calculate the phase space, that roughly speaking, it's a polynomial up to something like the 10th or the 11th power of the energy that's released in the decay. And these energies typically are in the ballpark of anywhere from 1 up to 4 MeV. And so you get a certain fraction coming out of that Q value. On the other hand, in the case of the no neutrino decay, what you find is that you have, for the two real leptons that are coming out, you have a Q to the fifth. But then, because of the exchange of the virtual particle over here, the separation between nucleons inside the nucleus is of the order of a few Fermi. And that corresponds to roughly a mean energy over here of not a few MeV, but a few tens of MeV. And so if you calculate the ratio of these two phase spaces, you can get a factor of 10 to the 6 or more enhancement for this process as far as the phase space is concerned. And that's, of course, what Wendell Furry observed. Namely, that you could get lifetimes instead of 10 to the 17, you could get lifetimes of the order 10 to the 11, 10 to the 12. Now, that's still a long time from the point of view of geology, but it's a much shorter time than than was proposed by Maria Mayer's calculation. And until the discovery of parity non-conservation and the two-component theory, that was thought to be the way by which you could distinguish the two decay modes, namely that if you saw a much faster decay of the order of 10 to the 11, 10 to the 12 years lifetime, then that would be an indication of the no neutrino decay and of a Majorana neutrino. Of course, now we know that there is this inhibiting factor because of the helicity of the neutrino, that if the neutrino were perfectly massless, then you couldn't have the exchange because the helicity of one particle is the opposite from the helicity of the other, and therefore the decay would be absolutely ruled out. And that also means that this gives you a great sensitivity. Because you have this large phase space enhancement, that gives you sensitivity to relatively small parameters here that describe the breaking of absolute helicity of the two neutrino and antineutrino. So that was the situation in 1939 when Furry calculated the no neutrino decay for the first time. The first experiments in double beta decay were what came to be known as geochemical experiments. And the idea of those experiments was that since the lifetime is so long, you want to try and do an experiment that integrates over a long time. And the kind of experiments people observed might be possible were ones in which the daughter nucleus would be a noble gas like krypton or xenon, and if the decay takes place in an ore which is billions of years old and which you can date by some other means, then because they're chemically inert, krypton and xenon would just accumulate in the ore and not get lost. And so you would look for decay. You would look for the daughter nucleus. You would look for the xenon or the krypton. And the first experiment that was done by Ingram and Reynolds was one in which you look for tellurium going to xenon 130 particularly, and also 128 as two candidates. And in the first experiment done in 1950, they had an indication that there was a double beta decay. Of course, the problem with these geochemical experiments is that if you see a signal in a particular isotope, if there's an excess of one particular isotope compared with the natural abundance of that isotope, then you have to be able to argue that all processes other than double beta decay are only minor contributors to that. So you really get a limit rather than a direct measurement. The best experiment along these lines, the experiment in which the authors were really able to rule out all the, or most of the alternative sources for the xenon 130 was an experiment carried out by these gentlemen in 1968, and they obtained a lifetime of approximately 2 × 10^21 years. The first observation in a laboratory experiment of double beta decay was carried out a long time later by Elliot, Hahn, and Moe, and I'll say some more about that in a while, in which they looked at selenium, the decay of selenium 82 to krypton 82, and what they did was develop a time projection chamber in which you would see the tracks of the double beta decays going off in these directions. Is somebody giving me a signal? So that was carried out in 1987-88, in which that particular experiment was performed. And I'll say a little bit more about that later on. These are extremely difficult experiments, and if you look at the history of the experiments that were carried out prior to that, the big problem is the background, as Harry was talking about earlier at lunchtime. It's very easy, if you're looking at a lifetime of 10^20 years, it's very easy to be fooled by a trace element, say one part in 10^9, with a lifetime of 10^9 years, it's very easy to be fooled by backgrounds like that, especially if they produce two electrons in some way. So the simple idea of the Dirac versus Majorana neutrino was the question of whether the charge conjugate of the neutrino is identical or not. In the case of the K0, of course, we know by virtue of strangeness that there is a distinction. And as Rackar observed in 1937, because of baryon number or because of the magnetic moment, you couldn't think of the neutron as being its own antiparticle. So the Majorana, so the neutrino is really the only candidate that we know at this particular time, the only fermionic candidate where this is true. Where this is a possibility. And let me say also that the distinction, as I indicated before, in the standard electroweak model, because of the zero mass of the neutrino, this distinction really doesn't have any meaning, because the left-handed neutrino and the right-handed particle, whatever you call it, really can't communicate with one another. They're distinct. So as long as the mass is precisely zero, it's a matter of words rather than anything else. Now, one of the things in talking about the decay, of course, is that you have to look at these nuclear transitions. And the characteristic of these even nuclei, like germanium-76 and selenium-82, the characteristic is that their ground states are spin zero and positive parity. So when you have a transition of that kind over here, the leptons have to arrange themselves in such a way that all their helicities cancel out, so that they carry off no net angular momentum. And you can see from this particular figure here, the two electrons are going to go off in opposite directions, or tend to go off in opposite directions. The same would be true, of course, if the no neutrino decay were to take place. The same thing would happen, namely that as long as the electrons have the same left-handed helicity, they will go off basically in opposite directions in a spin zero to spin zero transition. And that's one reason why this experiment over here is able to adopt the setup in which you have here, in this experiment you have here a selenium source sandwiched between these two plates over here within the time projection chamber, and one electron will go off in one direction or tend to go off in opposite direction so that you are consistent with what's going on in the nuclear physics. You have to be very careful about all kinds of backgrounds, and in doing the experiment, Elliot, Hahn, and Moe really had to do a great deal in order to clean things. As I mentioned, you have very small contaminations of one part in 10 to the 9 or more, and they can easily fool you. The big background that they dealt with was bismuth 214, which has, which is a single beta decay emitter, but then it knocks out another electron from the orbital electrons around the bismuth, and then something like 160 microseconds later, it decays by alpha emission. And so, in order to rule out that background, you have to look for a delayed coincidence in which you see the two electrons come out, but then roughly 160 microseconds later, you see the alpha particle. And Mike Moe was very careful in looking for that background and being able to identify that background in order to say whether a particular event was a double beta decay or a background from bismuth 214. And one of the things in doing the experiment, he had to make this selenium plate over here, the selenium source, thin enough so that the alpha particle really could get out and be detected. And that limited the sensitivity of his experiment. To give you another idea of how difficult this experiment was, over a three-day period, you get something like 90,000 counts. And of those 90,000 counts, only one would be the double beta decay that you're looking at. And that's, of course, characteristic of a lot of these neutrino experiments in low energy, that the number of counts that you get in at least the early experiments is of the order of one per day or less. If you think of Ray Davis's experiment, again, his average count was something like a half an event a day. Now, of course, what you're looking for in that experiment is you're looking at the sum of the energies of the two electrons. If you have the two neutrino process, then of course the energy released is shared between the two electrons and the two neutrinos, and you'll get a distribution of this kind over here, and it goes to zero with, by a high power of E minus E zero down here. And then if you want the no neutrino decay, then what you have to do is find this spike at the end, because the no neutrino decay is characterized by the two electrons carrying off the total energy released. So in the case of Mike Moe, he plotted out this curve over here for the first time. He really had a good distribution of the two neutrino decay. That in itself was quite an experimental triumph, which has not been, I think, given the kind of recognition it really deserves, given that he looked at a lifetime of the order 10 to the 20 years. He didn't see any signal for this. An alternative experimental method for looking at the decay was invented by Goldhaber and Termatiosian in the late 40s, early 50s. And that was a method by which you try and make the source and the detector one and the same thing. In other words, you would have a crystal, in their case, which was rich in calcium-48, which is one of the candidate double beta decay isotopes. And when the two electrons are emitted, it causes the crystal to scintillate. And so you can use the crystal as both the source that you're looking for and also the detector of the decay. And that method has been adopted by a large number of experiments using germanium-76 instead of calcium-48, which doesn't have as high an energy release, but nevertheless has other favorable properties. And so in a case like that, and in a case like that, what you would do is look in your scintillation counter look in your counter and try and measure the spectrum that you see and look and see whether at the energy release of the germanium-76, about 2.04 MeV, is there an excess signal there? Now, in the last year or so, Klapdor has claimed in the Moscow-Heidelberg experiment that indeed he really does have a signal at that endpoint. He does have the longest exposure of something like between 50 and 60 kilogram years in terms of this experiment. So I'll mention something about that later on. Now, in looking at the double beta decay, if we think of it in terms of the quarks that are involved, you have on the lower half over here, you have the standard two neutrino process that is allowed, as I say, by the standard model, and then the no neutrino decay over here, in which you start off to begin with a neutrino exchange between the two, and then you have to have some mechanism which enables the helicity flip to take place. And the two mechanisms that people have considered are either that the neutrino has a mass over here, or alternatively that there is a small admixture in the Hamiltonian of right-handed currents in addition to the left-handed currents. And I'll talk a little bit about these two parameters over here. This is the parameter for the mass term. This involves the mass of the neutrino. This is its CP eigenvalue. And this is the matrix element in the mixing matrix of the electron neutrino coupled to the ith mass eigenvalue. Over here, you have a similar thing with, in this case, this would be the left-handed neutrino sector, this would be the right-handed neutrino sector, and this is the parameter that you get out of that. But before I get into those, let me just go through a little bit of the formal analysis. In the case of the neutrino, you can write down, if you think in terms of one generation for the moment, you've got the left and right-handed neutrino and their charge conjugates, and you can write down a general mass term which involves nu bar nu. That's the standard mass term for any particle. But in addition, because the neutrino has zero electric charge and, as far as we know, zero magnetic moment, you could also write down an additional term which couples the neutrino to its charge conjugate over here. And in this one-generational case, if you diagonalize this, your eigenvalues are the Dirac plus or minus the Majorana term, and your eigenvectors are the neutrino plus or minus its charge conjugate. And so you get two eigenvectors, one of which under C or CP goes into plus itself, and the other goes into minus itself. And you can think of a Dirac neutrino as a linear superposition of these two, one with plus the CP eigenvalue, one with minus the CP eigenvalue. And of course, when you have many generations, these M's over here, of course, these whole things become matrices. And over here, you'll have a Majorana mass matrix, but when you go through the diagonalization, you come out with basically the same set of results, namely that the eigenvectors are always Majorana neutrinos with either CP plus 1 or CP minus 1, and you have a whole set of eigenvalues of this matrix plus or minus that matrix to diagonalize. Then if you look at the basic interaction that you assume, in this case I've put down here, assuming that you're going over many generations here and many generations here, the interaction you think about is shown at the bottom here. here is the dominant term, a left-handed hadronic current times a left-handed leptonic current, and then you assume that there can be admixtures described by these parameters, eta prime, eta double prime, where you mix up the currents, and you even have this term over here as well. Typically, based on the kind of argument that I mentioned about the phase space, typically you expect these parameters to be of order 10 to the minus 3 or smaller using the current limits. where these factors come from, you have to do the, you look at the leptonic part of the amplitude and you look for the cross terms, and depending on which cross terms, you have this propagator for your neutrino. So this one here with the mass term links links the left, and this one over here links the left. And so the mass amplitude is proportional to the mass term over here, and the right-handed is proportional to this term over here. So if you look at the parameterization that you get for these things, you have that the effective mass over here is this sum that I pointed out before, and you can easily see from these parameters here, these lambdas are plus or minus 1, then assuming the masses are positive eigenvalues, this whole thing then has to be less than whatever the maximum mass is. So in other words, if you measure a non-zero value of this parameter, then you know that there has to be at least one mass in the eigenvalue spectrum that is greater than that particular value. Then as far as the right-handed current is concerned, there was a theorem that Boris Kaiser and his colleagues were responsible for showing that even in the left-right case, if you're working in a gauge theory where your gauge theory has only positively, only singly charged gauge bosons, even there it turns out that the requirement requires a non-zero mass. And the reason is that if you look at this part of the matrix, of the amplitude here, you've basically got E plus E minus going to W minus over here. And if you try to calculate that, as long as there are no counter terms, it would be a divergent. It would be a divergent matrix element, and so what you need is something to cancel that out. And so what you have to assume, if you write that amplitude down, is that this product of lambda I times the product of the matrices has to be zero. In order to avoid that. And then if you look at the structure of this term involving the left-right interference, you can see in the case of small masses that the leading term over here actually does cancel out, and you're left with terms which depend only on the mass. So even though you might think to begin with that the left-right interference avoids the issue of neutrino mass in terms of a gauge theory with no doubly charged gauge bosons, in fact it doesn't. So you have to have a non-zero mass. You can also use this then to give you an upper bound on the, or rather a lower bound on the largest mass eigenvalue given this expression over here, and that of course depends on the nuclear physics. Now one amusing game that one can apply is to take this result of Klapdor and his collaborators' claim that they really do see a signal for the two neutrino decay with a lifetime of 1.6 10 to the 25 years, and an M beta, their best value is about 400 millielectron volts. Now let me say that I believe at this point that millielectron volts should be the units that we use for neutrino masses, given that all we know. So I'm going to work in those units over there. Now, I know that there's been a great deal of critical review of this experiment, and it's not universally accepted, but as a theorist, I'm going to take the liberty of saying, let's suppose that he's in the right ballpark, and explore some of the things that might happen with this. So if we take this as 400 millielectron volts, that means that there has to be some maximum mass eigenvalue which is greater than or equal to this. And just to be conservative, let me assume that the maximum is equal to the 400 millielectron volts, and let M2, the next one below it, be 400 minus a delta, and then the M1 be M2 minus a delta 1. Then one of the games you can play, and it may well be that people have played this before. I know there are lots of theory papers on this. suppose you take the atmospheric delta M squared, which is about 3,000 millielectron volts squared, and you try and fit it by taking M3 squared minus M2 squared, then you find that this delta 2 over here is about 4 millielectron volts. And then if you take the large mixing angle solution for the solar neutrino and assume that that's basically an oscillation between involving M1 and M2, then that's about 30 millielectron volts. And if you plug that in, it implies that this delta 1 is about 4 times 10 to the minus 2 millielectron volts. So what this result means in a picture like this is that the neutrinos are really highly degenerate. And the splittings between them are very small. Now, as I say, we don't know that our friend Klapdor is correct, and we look forward to future experiments which will tell us one way or another whether he's correct and whether this 400 millielectron volts really is the right ballpark for the Majorana mass of the neutrino. You can even then ask the question about LSND, which is being subject to test right now at Fermilab with a mini-Boone experiment, and maybe in a couple of years we'll have a real answer as to whether that is correct or not. But in the LSND, tells us that the delta M squared is roughly 10 to the 6 millielectron volts. And if you adopt a picture where you have three down here and the fourth one, the sterile one, is up here, then it tells you that this M4 is about 1100 millielectron volts, 1.1 eV. So I'll leave those numbers out there and we'll see what experiment has to tell us in the future. Let me offer a word of caution. I know that there's a lot of skepticism about LSND because it doesn't fit the kind of, standard assumptions or prejudices of theorists. But I think we should all keep in mind that there was a time when people assumed that the mixing of neutrinos would be very similar to the CKM matrix, where you would have very small mixing angles. And the reality appears to be very different from that. So if I were a betting person, I would take that into account as far as LSND is concerned and maybe give it a 50-50 chance of being correct. What about some of the experiments that people are talking about for the future? I guess I haven't said much about the nuclear physics of this at this point, but let's the intimate extraction of these values is, of course, intimately involved with calculating the nuclear matrix elements in all of these cases. In the case of the two neutrino decay, it's a standard second order Hamiltonian, and what you do is you have an intermediate nuclear state over here. You neglect this energy dependence over here and generally do a closure. And then people can then try and calculate what the nuclear matrix element is. There was a time when the calculations seemed to give a much shorter lifetime than was actually observed. I'm not sure what the latest situation is. Maybe Wick can tell us what that is. Then, assuming that that will be under control, one can then extract mass parameters. Generally speaking, people seem to think there's maybe a factor of three or so in the extraction, an uncertainty of three in the extraction. There are a whole series of experiments that have been either done or being done. This, the Heidelberg-Moscow experiment, at one time it gave this value as the lower limit on the lifetime. Now, as I say, at least Klapdor believes that it is actually about 1.6, 10 to the 25. There are other enriched germanium experiments which have been done in the past that get corresponding types of lifetime. Another experiment that's of great interest now, that's 126. There's a great deal of interest in using xenon 136. There's an experiment that's going on by people at Stanford and Slack to look at the double beta decay of xenon 136 using a similar kind of technique to Mike Moe, except that they also want to be able to observe the final state nucleus by a very clever idea that Mike Moe originally introduced of trying to excite the final state nucleus by a unique laser technique. And if that works, that will do a great deal to reduce the background. There are other experiments on tellurium 130 using cryogenic techniques. That's going on at Gran Sasso right now, and there's a test of that called the big experiment is called Quarry. And again, in all of these experiments, people are going from kilogram sources to ton sources, and there's a trial of that technique that's going on at Gran Sasso right now. Then there are other experiments with molybdenum 100 which might come about. I don't have any great details of the latest things on those experiments, but I'm sure if they're successful, we'll hear a lot about them in time. So I think I'll conclude at this point. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What is your sense of the prospects for improving the precision, for want of a better term, with which one can calculate the mean matrix element?
Do you want to answer that? let me try first. I guess the way people have tried to go about that is by saying, well, we've measured the two neutrino decay, which of course is a somewhat different matrix element, but nevertheless, can you calculate the lifetimes of the two neutrino decay in the specific cases of interest, such as the selenium 82 that Mike Moe measured, or the two neutrino decay in the germanium 76 has also been observed by the same technique that people are using. So one guide you can have is, can you do a good calculation of those measured lifetimes? And if you can do a good calculation of those measured lifetimes, then you have at least some degree of confidence that you understand the nuclear physics reasonably well enough. And that's about, you know, really about as far as I think you can go at this in this case. I don't know, Wick, whether you would
I think one of the problems too is that there's no way in theory to filter out old results. So you have a 10 to 20 years of different calculations and standardized rates. It's clear to me that in the last, say, 10, 5, 10 years, there's been some really remarkable improvements, especially in the comparative say, in Madrid, germanium and selenium. They add one number to a database of other theory numbers. I think the experimentalists don't know how to respond. So they traditionally take the view that you look at the whole span of theory calculations and answer error bar. We should be able to do better than that.
But of course, I mean, when you get into the details of the no neutrino matrix element, it is different from the two neutrino. So there's no cast iron handle on it. I would say that maybe one way to think about it is to think in terms of this larger picture of not just the double beta decay, but also what you know from the oscillations, and see whether the kind of numbers that you get out of experiments like Klapdoor's give you a kind of a consistent picture which really hangs together. Yeah.
Is there any background from electron neutrino sources like the sun that at some level simulate this so that you get a E minus neutrino, one neutrino in the farthest thing instead of two neutrinos?
You mean E minus plus nucleus? I mean neutrino plus nucleus.
You have an initial electron neutrino instead of a final state anti-neutrino.
Double beta.
I mean, at some level, if you're talking about 100 tons of some material, is there some point where solar neutrinos come in? Or the number's just too small?
I would guess offhand they'd be, you know, certainly the only ones I think you'd worry about would be, say, the boron 8 neutrinos with energies, say, 7 or 8 MeV. But you're looking at a second order cross section, that would be extremely
small.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
The problem is the electron energy is going to give you the transition energy. Neutrinos are bringing some energy to them.
But it'll be a different spectrum, and then the question is where the end point of the spectrum goes in the
background. There is an old paper on this by Alex Landing years and years ago, and he was addressing this because of the geochemical experiments.
Mm-hmm.
As I recall, it's a couple of orders of magnitude below the limits that were then being sought.
Well, just 100 tons, I'm just worried that you might start to see that.
But you see the two neutrinos anyway.
But it has a spectrum that's moved over then closer to the endpoint. The question is it the worst background than the two neutrino decay?
So
at some level, it's just a question of what point.
So if you're looking at the endpoint, then if you're right that the phase space is more favorable for that reaction, so you have to fold that with the.
I mean, one of the key things in all of this, of course, is your energy resolution. So how much of, even though that spectrum is very small at the end, how good is your resolution? That's one of the things that Klapdoor claims that he has under very good control, is very good energy resolution. Sid?
We got room full of experts here. Can I find out what people think about Klapdoor's results?
Well,
let me just comment that there is no experimentalist in the universe who factors improvements on these results.
Mm-hmm.
Except those who were on the
page.
Yeah.
Can you get any nuclear information by doing an experiment, for example, like ion double charge exchange, which would give you the transition between these?
I'm not sure. You might be able to. You'd have to do it on one of these nuclei. It may be, but of course the pions are going to be much higher energy to do anything. You're not going to have very slow pions. But then of course it's a very different matrix element because they're much larger. Momentum transfers in it, and chances are you might knock something out or break up the nucleus.
No, you can do the experiment in which you select a small momentum transfer. Mm-hmm. It's the sort of thing that no one will bother to do. Mm-hmm. But if there's some reason for the double beta decay to do it, mm-hmm. someone will do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you put your Washington hat back on, the next generation experiments are going to cost $50 to $100 million.
Uh-huh.
Is there any chance of actually getting that much money in the U.S. for a new experiment?
I think if the community makes a strong enough case for it, yes. Uh-huh.
Okay, let's thank Peter.
I'm going to gather all this stuff up.